Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, and podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. Today we'll be talking to Graham Gibson and Margaret Atwood, two of Canada's greatest writers, who will be in Albuquerque tonight and here in Santa Fe tomorrow at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts in a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians. I'm delighted now to welcome Graham Gibson. His new book is The Bedside Book of Beasts, a wildlife miscellany. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure.
So this is a wonderful book. Your last one that we talked about here in the cafe was The Bedside Book of Birds. It's writings and visual images from all over the world about animals, people, predators and prey, the stories we tell about animals. How did you collect and assemble the material for the book?
Oh, boy. Obsessively, I think is the first response. It was part of the fun of doing the book. I just followed my nose. I found a lot of stuff on the web, a lot of the images on the internet. But it was 3.5 or 4 years of just researching and exploring and talking to people. One writer would lead me to another one, and I have some friends who are real bibliophiles, and I'd say to them, tell me about beast books, and it all came in. I think there's something over 120 excerpts of prose, and for everyone that's in there, I'll bet I had four or five others.
It's tremendously, I was thinking about doing it. I mean, if you're inclined that way, it's a tremendously fun, although possibly unwieldy project.
Well, it wasn't so much as unwieldy as just one had to be persistent. I was quite obsessive about it. I mean, I did very little else. I've got a special desk in my room where I work, which is piled up with stuff I should have been doing over the last year.
Right.
And I let as much lie there as possible. And now I've got to catch up on it, of course. But I found this book, oddly enough, I found this book much more interesting and compelling than the bird book. I think the bird book was wonderful. I was a bird watcher. I mean, I am a bird watcher. But when I got into the beasts, I suddenly discovered I was into something much richer for me, which perhaps we can explore as we talk.
Well, let's talk about the word beast. It's kind of a charged term, and in a way it puts a barrier between human beings and these so-called beasts, but the book really explores the nature of those boundaries or whether they're real.
Yeah, well, I think it isn't so much the word beast that stands between us and the animals. We have a long, long history of trying to separate ourselves from the animal world. There's a wonderful, if somewhat complex, book called The Animal-Human Boundary. And it's a whole series of essays on through various stages of our civilization and our culture, of how we tried to insist that we weren't animals, and we became quite, in some cases, very disturbed if anyone suggested we were. And it was part of us separating ourselves from nature, I think.
Well, as you start the book talking about one of the things that separated us from nature and from our place in nature was the human ability to hunt from a distance. And I thought that was such a simple and important concept.
Yeah, and it's something I hadn't known and I hadn't read. I'm sure other people have noticed it. But one of the points that I learned and one of the points I make in the book is that predators cannot afford to be hurt. They only succeed about one every 10 times anyway, most of them. And even the hooves of a deer, the sharp hooves of a deer, can do real damage to a wolf and even a lion, particularly with septicemia and so forth. And that over the whole slow process of evolution, the animals have learned that. They learned they can't afford to be hurt, so they always take the weakest one. Now, in taking the weakest prey instead of the strongest, they're strengthening the genetic pool of the prey. And it's in that way that predators and prey drive animal evolution, I think. When human beings, with our very clever brain, when we discovered weapons that allowed us to kill from a distance, where we didn't have to get in close with the animal that we were killing, we could afford to kill the ones with the most fat, the ones with the most food, the ones with the biggest antlers, which meant at that point, as soon as we started that, we were working against the evolution of the healthiest prey animals.
And that's such an important concept, because when people sometimes talk about how the wolves have been wiped out and then deer are proliferating and the solution is, well, just let people hunt deer, that doesn't work very well, because we're hunting the, human beings are hunting the strongest rather than the weakest members of that species.
That's right. When we the wolves are a natural check on their prey, or tigers are the natural check on their prey. All of the big predators are. And that's why I think I say at one point that without an alpha predator, there is no wilderness. That you have to have the natural balance that a major predator will maintain by killing the weak animals. But we shoot the ones with the biggest, the ones that make us feel powerful and sexy. We shoot the ones with the biggest head of antlers, or the ones with the most fat, or what we're looking for is the biggest fish, and so on and so forth.
Another thing that came up in this whole conversation about prey is the important concept that predators never wipe out the population that they eat. They really just sort of keep it in check. And
That's right. Kind
of runs against the fears that people have about wolves, for example, in terms of livestock and things like that.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that I don't think we had any trouble with, when we were hunter-gatherers, we didn't have any trouble with how the world worked, but our relationship with animals. I mean, I think all those wonderful shape changings and shamans and mythic stuff associated with powerful animals, once we settled down and became agriculturalists or pastoralists, the important animals became the ones we own. They became the domestic animals that are ours, along with the land that they're on, which is also ours. And as soon as you do that, then the ones that are out there, they're the outlaws. They're the vermin. They're the ones who eat our sheep or our chickens. And so we end up demonizing them and killing them even when we don't need to. I mean, there's still in some places in North America, there's still a bounty on wolves.
That's right. And in New Mexico, it's certainly a major issue, because the wiping out of wolves is a great problem with big fights on both sides. This issue of what happened when we became agriculturalists, which biblically is, I suppose, our punishment being expelled from the Garden of Eden, it wasn't the great thing that, at least at first, that it was cracked up to be. Life didn't necessarily get better for human beings, at least for a while.
No, there's a wonderful piece. Jared Diamond has a piece, which I think one can get on the Internet, called The Greatest Mistake the Human Race Has Ever Made. And he's gone to the work that scientists are doing on looking at the bones of both hunter-gatherers and then of the early pastoralists, and discovering that once we settled down, we had far more diseases. We get many of our diseases from the animals we've domesticated, diphtheria and all that kind of thing. And that people died younger, and that the farmers and pastoralists were appreciably shorter and showed many more signs of not only disease but of injury than did the hunter-gatherers. So that I think, I mean, at some level, I mean, that's people argue, I think quite rightly, that that's when the subjugation of women began, that the hunter-gatherer, male and female, tended to have a balanced relationship. The women gathered certain kinds of food, looked after the young, the man went out and hunted. And in the process, they both had a lot more time than the farmers had. That hunters in a traditional hunting-gathering society in a healthy community, in a healthy environment, they had to hunt less than a week out of the month to provide food for everyone. And that the women's work, including the children and gathering food, they estimated was between 1 and 3 hours a day. Once you get a farm, you have to protect it. You want more land. You have to have more sons, usually, in order to protect the land, to work the land, and to gain more land. So that on some level, it radically changed who we were. And as I suggest in the book, it domesticated us. That we now have become domesticated animals ourselves.
And that is questionable. It's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's something that I think your book, in a very wonderful way, gives us a chance to maybe sit in our warm, comfortable beds. It's called The Bedside Book of Beasts by Graham Gibson, whom we're talking to, and think about these things, what we've traded away and what we've gained and what kind of a gain it is, particularly in this time of environmental degradation, which threatens our species as well as every other.
Yeah, I think what it is what I think, first of all, one has to make a distinction of the damage done to us as a species is less obvious amongst, say, most of your listeners and most people that we know. It's the very poor. It's the great swarming cities in the third world, where people are more like battery hens, living more like battery hens than they are. And I think I say in the book, we live more like polo ponies or Kobe beef or something. I mean, those of us who have jobs and have some money and a house. But the growing population of humans who are in desperate situation through no fault of their own is a measure, I think, of the damage done by what we did when we became agriculturalists. The whole question of birth control and the overwhelming population the world is now got.
It's interesting that when you compare the way we live to ponies, to beef, to hens, mm-hmm. to ants, mm-hmm. we always seem to compare ourselves to the animal kingdom. And there's a section of the book in which there are all kinds of deities where there are hybrid animal-human figures who play a big role in mythology. What is the function of these stories? What are we doing when we compare ourselves to animals?
Well, I think that we didn't so much compare ourselves with animals, that originally that we knew we were animals, and that we were living in the world, in a way that most of the other animals were living. When our ancestors, our forebears, came out of the forest onto the grasslands, that what we did then really is our culture began to be formed, because we hunted as small groups. Family groups, like the wolves, like the lions, the other creatures that were in the grasslands. And then as we came out, we saw that their method of living together with a closely knit family, but also able to live on their own, utterly on their own, and then come back to the family for breeding, whatever it may be, that worked very well indeed. And we saw in the animals powers that we wanted, in a sense, to have, because we didn't have the physical strength of the tearing claws, or couldn't run as fast as the cheetah. We had to devise our own strategy for hunting and for living. But we learned an enormous amount from the animals, because the other animals, because we, on some level, instinctively knew that's what we were.
And the forgetting of that, I suppose, is one of the great problems that we're dealing with now, as you're really alluding to.
Yeah. And I mean, the thing is that it's interesting. All of us who write books about what's happening to nature and our place in it and so forth, and the threats and the rewards of it, as we come towards the end of a book, we have to figure some way of saying something that isn't totally negative, and you find out where in fact the strengths and the joy of all this is. My sense is, I'm where I'm sitting now, I'm in Toronto, in my room. I look out, and we're fortunate enough to have a line of linden trees, and the leaves are all turning. And it's the most wonderful thing there this time of year to see them. And it isn't just aesthetic, that somehow those the leaves falling and the blue sky beyond them, that's a very, very ancient knowledge we have. And to partake of nature is a kind of fulfillment for us. And it's becoming increasingly difficult to do so. And that is doing damage to us.
As you say in the book, there's genuine health benefits to spending time in nature, or even looking out the window at nature, or even looking at a picture of nature.
And these benefits are, in fact, demonstrable. I mean, studies are being done that make it very clear that, for example, blood pressure goes down, will go down for people who go into nature, that kids with attention deficit disorder, whatever it's called now, are much improved by spending time in nature. There's a book by a fellow called Richard Louv, L-O-U-V, called The Last Child in the Woods. And what he's arguing, quite persuasively, is that a lot of attention deficit disorder, I think there's another term for it now, is nature deficit disorder. And given that we live for 80 or 90,000 generations in nature, becoming who we are, And then suddenly, so many of us find ourselves in the middle of cities, and there's the fear that children can't go out and play because, or that you can't afford to have swimming pools in the schools anymore, or you can't take them on trips to the country, so that they are spending more and more time with the artificial games, which in fact our commerce produces. That it's clearly not good for them. It's clearly not good for us. And it's not a moral thing. You know, I'm not talking, let's go out and nature's beautiful or something. It's a physiological thing. It's a psychological thing.
Well, maybe it's beautiful because we're adapted to think it's beautiful because we need it.
Yes, and because we have, as a species, spent so much time in it, that it is or was our home.
When you were writing about the great health benefits of nature and spending time outdoors, and there's a term called forest bathing, where when people go out into the forest, they come back healthier. It kind of reminded me of those conversations people have about how learning music leads to higher test scores in other subjects. But it's also very important to remember that music is a value of its own. It's not just because of its benefit of having higher test scores.
Oh, of course.
And nature, likewise.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, there's a very interesting, and I've not figured this out in my own head, but I find it is in my response to nature and my response to music, there's a great similarity, emotional similarity, that if I encounter something in nature that really moves me, it's surprisingly close to a passage in Beethoven or whatever that moves me. And it seems to be a similar kind of response. I have a young friend who did a PhD thesis on the relationship between nature and music.
Very interesting. Yeah. And there are some passages in the book that speak to that. For example, there's a section about how bears like to dance and coyotes like to sing. So there's a continuity. All these things that we think of as discontinuities between the human and the animal realms, the more we observe them, the more there is an actual continuity there.
Actually, well, there's a very interesting piece recently from an American bear biologist who's doing a lot of work up close with the bears. I mean, he's got some to trust him. And he said that they hum when they're happy.
Wow.
One of the sad things is how terribly wrong we've been about animals for a very, very long time. There's a very good example of it. I don't know if you remember reading or you saw a piece about a chimpanzee in a zoo in Scandinavia, in Norway, I think. And the chimp had become really irritated by all the people who came and stared at it in its enclosure. It had a nice outdoor, it was a nice enclosure and everything, but all these people came and stared at it. So it got up very early in the morning before anybody else was around, and it started collecting rocks, stones, and it put them in strategic places around the enclosure so it could throw them at the people when they came. And that's foresight. That's foresight. It's forethought. That's planning.
Right.
20 years ago, no one would have accepted this. There'd be no peer review of such a thing. And when they took all the stones out of the enclosure, this chimpanzee discovered that with one stone that was left, if it went around tapping the cement in its fairly large pool of water, tapping and tapping, it could detect where the concrete was rotten. And there it would break it open, and so it started collecting concrete to throw at them.
Wow.
So, that, I mean, our sense is always that they are the dumb animals, we say.
But yeah, or we say that we say they're dumb, or even when they're smart, they're totally instinctual, but they're learning and being creative. Maybe not exactly in the same way that we are, but the same type of thing.
Yeah, well, if they couldn't be exactly the same way as us, because all of our talents are the ones that are appropriate for our survival. You know, and then obviously, a chimpanzee needs different strategies than you or I, and we need different strategies from polar bears. But all creatures that live successfully in the world are the ones who have learned how to do it. And that's usually a fairly complicated thing.
We're talking to Graham Gibson. His new book is called The Bedside Book of Beasts. One thing that we do seem to do differently than most other animals is have the chance to die of old age, to die peacefully, to die surrounded by our loved ones, to think about death and prepare for it spiritually. Is that a distinctly human thing?
Yeah, because a whole lot of us, if you look at all the people in the world, the vast majority of us do not die like that.
Right.
But those of us who can, that's our self-consciousness. And one wonders, for example, that the worry we have, if the worry we have about dying, which comes and goes, and whether how you balance it out, would you maybe be better off if you didn't know? Although elephants, for example, they know when one of their members have died, and they perform small ceremonial, almost like funerals for them. They'll come back and they will visit the bones of a family member. So perhaps they know more about it than you and I think.
Yeah, and again, another continuity, seemingly human cultural practices, it turns out, exists among elephants.
Absolutely. I mean, and again, because we despite our long history of denying and being denied our relationship with a healthy, natural world, despite all that, I think we recognize in the animal world when we are open to it, how many things we share.
There is an evolution, certainly, of cultural practices involving spiritual offerings and respect for the soul of animals that we kill, that we human beings kill,
yeah,
that we hunt.
Yes,
how do you understand that?
Well, there's the quotation from an Inuit or what used to be called Eskimo shaman, in which he was being interviewed by this wonderful Greenland Danish researcher in the early 20th century. And he says that the hardest thing that we have, the shaman said, the most difficult and frightening fact of our life is that everything we kill, and everything for food or for shelter or for clothing, because among the Inuit, of course, in the north, most of what they killed and ate during the whole of, certainly all of it during the winter, was in fact animals, and most of the clothing was made from animals. He said that all of those creatures that we have to kill in order to live have souls, and they have souls that survive their body, and we are afraid of those souls, and so we do what we can to appease them. We give thanks, and some of the really early rituals among North American Native peoples were very elaborate thanks, because if you believe that an animal has a soul, and there's many who believe that nature, in fact, I mean, the animists and so forth, there's a great tradition of believing that everything out there alive has something sacred in it. And that if you believe that, then you must give thanks. And as I say in the book, initially the thanks was to the animal itself. But once we came up with an anthropomorphic God, the notion of God as a version of God, or God a version of us, that then we started thanking the God, not the animal. And as I say in the book, most of us don't thank anybody anymore.
That's right. Just sometimes the vestiges of saying grace around the table is an example of that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, that's certainly what our grace was. I mean, when our daughter went to a school, in church school in England when we were there many years ago, the grace there was really quite a nice one. Thank you, God, for the gift of food in a hungry world. And now, I mean, there's very few of us who have, unless we are theologically religious, who are up to saying that when inviting clever friends to dinner.
I was thinking when I was reading this book, and of course it's a wonderful kind of book because you can skip around and look at the images and read this story and that story. It certainly doesn't have to go in order, and there are different sections and so on. But I was thinking that this is part of a larger movement that is a continuity from, for example, in the 19th century, the dominant empires didn't recognize slaves as human beings, and then mm-hmm. we do, and then we didn't recognize animals as somehow they're not the same as us, but really are equals as beings with souls. And we are coming to a really different understanding and more, I don't know if equal is the right word, but more equal understanding of animals as well.
Yeah, I think, I mean, and that's, it's, I think as it becomes increasingly clear that there's trouble out there, you know, whether you call it overpopulation or climate change or whatever it may be, or drought or floods or whatever you call it, that there's trouble out there, and that we are in some level all in it together. That the grasslands of the great prairie grasslands that are in such trouble, or forests that are, we all depend on them far more than we know again, and that you can't turn the whole world into huge teeming cities, like huge battery turkey farms, without doing terrible damage to the human soul.
And to the human ability to survive. I mean, there was...
Absolutely.
Oceanographers are talking about the human carrying capacity of the Earth diminishes, I don't know what it is, sixfold or tenfold when you kill the oceans, which we're in a rapid process of doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's hard on some level to know what acknowledging our position and our role in the animal world. And on some emotional level to make sense of our own lives on that, what that will do about climate change or whatever it is that's happening. I mean, climate change will do fine for me, but I think it's mostly overpopulation. We don't even talk about that anymore.
Right.
But that what there is that there's a heritage of life that is so ancient and so central to us. I mean, we can feel it in our bodies. I mean, I think it was Pascal said the heart has its reasons that reason does not know. And it occurred to me in writing this book to paraphrase that and saying the body has its reasons that reason doesn't know.
That's right.
And we all know on some level that our body tells us things and that our body recognizes things. That it's not reason that makes us respond to music. Music makes the body want to dance. No, I mean, there's a huge reality there that culturally we are inclined to ignore and to diminish. Richard Louv, in his book, The Last Child in the Woods, he said every single school class in the world should spend at least half a day a week in nature in all weather. I think he's right. Should be probably a whole day.
Yeah, yep.
You couldn't organize it, but because I think everybody. I mean, if you see a child, a young child, you take a young child into nature, she or he knows exactly what to do. They run and they laugh.
There's a school close to here of elementary school kids. It's a private school, and every Wednesday, all the kids in the school walk from wherever their school is to the park near my house, and they run around and play in the park. And I've talked to some of these kids and brought my dogs out to them, and they are some of the happiest, well-adjusted, most articulate school kids I've met, and I'm sure that that's part of it.
I'm sure it is, too, and there's a wonderful, I can't confirm this study, but someone was telling me that back when, I mean, even 30 years ago when kids played out in the street after school, and the mother said, when the streetlights come on, come home, that whole generations were doing that, and that now very, very few are because of the danger in the street, right? Or the perceived danger in the street.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Because what this study said was that it was more dangerous back then.
Exactly. Well, unfortunately, we have to go right now, but I want to thank you so much for being here, Graham Gibson, author of The Bedside Book of Beasts, and we look forward to seeing you here in Santa Fe.
I'm impatient to be there, and thank you very much.
And once again, Graham Gibson and his partner Margaret Atwood will be in Albuquerque tonight and at the Lensic Performing Arts Center tomorrow night in a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians. To find out more, go to the Wild Earth Guardians website. That's wildearthguardians.org. Margaret Atwood will be with us in just a moment. Please stay tuned. I'm delighted now to welcome Margaret Atwood. She is the author of over 40 books of fiction, poetry, and prose. Her latest novel is The Year of the Flood. She, along with her partner, Graham Gibson, will be at the Lensic Center for Performing Arts on Monday, November 17th at 7 in the evening. It's a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians, co-sponsored by Garcia Street Books. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
So this novel is set in some time in the unspecified but not too distant future in which a viral pandemic has wiped out most of the human race. And those who survived were people who were isolated in one way or another. They were quarantined or in jail or whatever. As you wrote this novel, did you imagine it as an extrapolation of the present, but basically realism, or something, I know you don't like the term science fiction, but something more in that direction of fantasy?
I don't mind the term science fiction. I just like to have it used precisely. So if one does use it, one has to say which lineage of science fiction it belongs to, and it belongs to the lineage that began with Jules Verne writing about things that might possibly be invented and happen, and went on through 1984 and Brave New World and things like Ridley Walker and Death of Grass by John Wyndham. So things that could happen on this planet as opposed to a galaxy far, far away, or invasion by squid-like monsters and tin cans. So there are two lines of it. So I'm of the first line, and you can call it science fiction if you want, but you have to then put a little subset saying this kind. Anyway, could it happen? No question. We have all of the tools for such an event in our hands right now, and that would be the fact that we've cracked the DNA code, and students and universities are happily now slicing and dicing to make little viruses of their own. So it's entirely conceivable. Will it happen? Well, not necessarily, because we have invented the hydrogen bomb and we haven't yet blown all of ourselves up with it. So we don't always use our edge tools destructively as soon as we've got them. But is it possible? Sure. As for the rest of the future in this book, we have those tools as well. So I wouldn't call it necessarily wild, made-up, deep, dark, gothic invention on my part. You might call it wild, inventive, deep, dark invention on the part of the human race who invents these things.
Right, right. The metaphor of the waterless flood has obviously biblical connotations, mankind being punished for their sins, and in this case the sins are in part ecological, or in very large part ecological. The tigers and the elephants and rhinoceroses.
Man-made species extinctions, which are going on right now. So whatever you may think of the cause of global warming, there is no doubt that the extinctions are being caused by us. So my group, called the God's Gardeners, take bits of scripture quite seriously, and like every other religious group, they cherry pick scripture to suit themselves and reinterpret it according to their own frame. But there's enough in there to support their views, for sure. And I don't know whether you know about the Green Bible yet, but it has made an appearance among us. It's got linen covers, it's got ecologically correct paper, it's got the green parts in green. It's got an introduction by Archbishop Tutu and a lot of green things that you can do at the end. And it takes the stewardship view as opposed to let's destroy it all, let it all burn, and God will make another one. So there are those two views right now on the planet, and there's already a green movement within Western North American Christianity, and some of the other world religions actually never lost their green roots. Let's mention Buddhism and Hinduism, and even the Quran, which is pretty specific about the rights of animals.
The God's Gardeners are a religion who have a theology that's really a fusion of scripture and science. And I have to say, it felt entirely plausible. Are there any groups that are doing this? Is this based on any actual religion?
I think it's going that way. It's a blend of science, religion, and nature. And some of the positions in Adam One's sermonettes are not my own invention. They have a tradition behind them. So although some of the readings, for instance, not everybody would interpret the passage where Jesus says, come with me and I'll make you fishers of men. Not everybody would interpret that as care for the fish by removing two fishermen from the fisherman pool, but you might read it that way. Some of the other theological positions, however, have long tradition. So are there any groups that are going that way? I think increasingly Western Christianity, which separated from its green roots in the late 17th and 18th centuries, when it was confronted by a mechanistic view of the universe, took the position that animals were basically machines. I think they are now reconnecting with their earlier, much greener roots. Go into any medieval cathedral, and what do you see? Carving around the pillars and on the pews and in the stained glass windows and decorations. You see a lot of creatures and plant life, because the inside of the cathedral was supposed to be a mirror of the universe, and that included everything that had been created. And the human scenes took place within that.
I think it's important and interesting that the way the book is set up, the way this religion is set up, there is no inherent conflict between religion and science, which is something that we are confronted with in our daily life, that the apparent opposition between those two things.
Well, it's not an opposition if you take the view that the word knowledge should apply to things that you can actually know and test, and the word faith should apply to things that you believe in. And I think one thing that happened to Christianity in the 19th century was that it went materialistic. It felt that it had to justify its beliefs in a materialistic way, in the same way that science was testing and proving things. And that simply removes meaning from the word faith. You know, if it's not a question of if everything has to be a question of knowledge, then you have to be able to submit it to a materialistic proof. Our gardeners take the opposite view. They say that things of the spirit are of the spirit, much as traditional Christianity has always said, and that spirits are not things. Therefore, any idea that you have to be able to measure spirits by electrical charges or spiritons or any other such device, that just goes out the window, because spirits are not material things. Don't you think that makes sense?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, the Apostles' Creed says God is a spirit, right?
Right.
In other words, God isn't a thing. God doesn't have a body.
Yeah, and I guess the thing is, we're in this sort of ridiculously constructed, or I think ridiculously constructed, political situation in which you have...
Well, you have people denying physics, chemistry, geology, archaeology,
exactly.
Deep history, DNA. That's all part of the material world, and therefore subject to material proof. And they're insisting that material world is in fact the same as the world of faith.
So in this historical moment in which you and I are living and sitting here talking on the radio, it is possible to both deeply love humanity and deeply love the rest of the natural world and witness the one destroying the other. And when I was reading The Year of the Flood, I felt, I guess I have to say, little or no sadness about the decimation of the human race. It was almost a kind of relief. And
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well,
there is that moment, and I have had people say similar things to me, and I think, boy, you know, unless we're willing to, there is another pathway, and that would be to change our ways now.
Exactly, but I mean, in the book, they haven't done that.
No, they haven't done it, no.
I mean, it's really, in a way, a call to us to be good gardeners, to be good guardians of life on Earth.
Well, if you want to continue, I mean, it isn't the whole natural world that man is going to succeed in destroying, because our human race is going to go before that happens. We are not going to be able to wipe out every microbe on the planet, but we are going to be able to do a pretty good job on ourselves.
Well, do you yourself feel that? I mean, when I thought, gosh, it's so good that most of them are gone, now the Earth can get back to its own business, I thought, boy, that's a pessimistic view. I mean, do you feel that way yourself?
Not really, because if I did feel that way, I wouldn't bother writing books, would I? Because what are books but human communication? So they're based on the idea that people can communicate with other people, and that's a worthwhile thing to do. And also, as I've gone about now in seven countries, talking about all of this stuff, you would be astonished at how much grassroots activity there is out there. The people on the ground are, in a way, way ahead of the politicians on this. And it goes everywhere from soil conservation to water conservation to green technologies being invented to local initiatives to nature conservancy. There's a lot of activity. Not enough, but there's a lot. So it's definitely it's growing in awareness and it's growing in activity. And people are getting involved on quite a scale. And I have to say, in connection with the God's Gardeners, that you don't do that simply for rational considerations. It has to be emotional. You don't put that kind of commitment into something unless you have an emotional attachment with that which you're trying to save.
We're talking to author Margaret Atwood about her new book, The Year of the Flood. The religion in the book is full of saints, and I loved the choice of saints. A lot of them were environmentalists, and some of them I'd never heard of, and some of them are very well known, Diane Fossey and Karen Silkwood, and I think
Rachel
Peter,
Carson, Rachel Al Gore.
Exactly.
E.O. Wilson.
But then some of them, was it your hope that we would stop reading for a moment and go look these people up?
If you wish, you can certainly do that. They're all online.
So St. Alexander Zawadzki, for example.
He's online.
A Polish communist of the early 20th century.
Well, he was a Polish environmentalist.
So they're basically all the saints are environmentalists of one kind or another.
They have to have had that. That's why they get to be saints. How they behaved in the rest of their life is not of much interest to the gardeners. It's only their environmental work or their work as naturalist that counts with the gardeners. So St. Francis is in there, of course, but only for his sermon to the fishes and things like that.
This book, I hope, will serve as a kind of vaccine against the disease of unrestricted corporate capitalism, I guess.
Well, it's when corporate capitalism and government become the same thing that you're really in trouble. Then you're really in trouble. It's what the Soviet Union was like, only kind of backwards. The government was the corporations, and in my book, the corporations are the government. But either melding of those things is really not good for ordinary citizens because they have no recourse. They've got no way of, they have no control over the media. They can't say, I'm being poisoned by the mercury in the water. They can't say any of that. They have no power to go up against it. So you don't want a combination of government and business in that way.
And not far off from where we are now in many living examples, obviously.
Well, when the big financial meltdown happened and governments started pouring their money into banks and automobile companies, I thought, I'm not sure you really want that to happen. But what was the choice?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like 1984, only with much more of a focus on the environment.
Well, 1984 was the Soviet Union model. That was when the governments are the businesses. And ours in this book, and the one that we find ourselves closer to at the moment, is the businesses are the government. So it's them calling, it's whoever's calling the shots.
There's one more thing I wanted to ask you about, and that is that the characters in this book, some of them are also in your previous novel, Oryx and Crake, which I now have to go read, but I was reading about that, and it's same time, some of the same people, different focus. Why did you choose to go back to that time and place
okay.
and set of characters?
My earlier work was done in the Victorian novel. Those novels were often quite long, and a lot of them are written in serial form, but they often had chapters called Meanwhile, or that began Meanwhile, and you knew when you came to the Meanwhile chapter that it was the same world. It was the same time frame, but it was other people in a different place. And you also knew that sooner or later, the people in the Meanwhile chapter were going to meet up with the people in the chapter you had just read. So there would be a meeting of those two characters, and they would all be of those two character sets, and they would all be worked in somehow. And so you might think of Year of the Flood as the meanwhile chapter. It's the same time. It's a group that's going to converge with the characters in the other book, and there's a lot of overlap in their stories. So what I wanted to do was look at a different part of the map. Oryx and Crake takes place within the elite, within the very gated communities that are now the big corporate and scientific enterprises. They actually have walls around them, which they kind of do now. And the Year of the Flood involves people who are very much not the elite. In fact, they're in the places in that society which are the most violent, most lawless, most out of control, most impoverished places in the society.
And I suppose it's no coincidence that in the first one it's the men who are the main characters, and the second it's the women.
Well, again, we're looking at a different part of the society, and it's true that we follow two female characters. We also follow a male character, namely Adam One, who is the leader of the gardeners. We follow him and his group.
Well, we are just about out of time, but I want to thank you, Margaret Atwood, for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great, and thank you.
Margaret Atwood will be in Santa Fe along with her partner, Graham Gibson, and the two of them will discuss their newly published books, The Year of the Flood and The Bedside Book of Beasts, and that's on Tuesday, November 17th at 7 o'clock at the Lenzik Center for Performing Arts in Santa Fe. It's a benefit for Wild Earth Guardians, and there's also a benefit party beforehand. You can get tickets and more information by calling Carol Norton at 505-988-9126, extension 1150, or by going to wildearthguardians.org. The event is co-sponsored by Garcia Street Books. And for our Albuquerque listeners, Margaret Atwood and Graham Gibson will be at Woodward Hall on the University of New Mexico campus on Monday, November 16th at 7 o'clock in the evening. Again, call Carol at 505-988-9126, extension 1150, for more information. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org. You can listen to the podcast anytime thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services at santafe.radiocafe.org. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.